Good morning. This is Carol Steckler at KLOILP, Lopez Island, Washington, 102.9 FM. And this morning there will not be a community calendar. I'm really pleased to have in the studio, recorded from last Sunday afternoon, Laurel Horn. She was born on Lopez and grew up here and is the daughter of Steve and Polly Horn. And she teaches in Washington, D.C. And we're going to talk a little bit about her journey as a teacher from Lopez Island and school and Spring Street, both schools that she attended. And let me remember if I said there won't be a community calendar. We're just going to visit with Laurel for this whole hour on Kitchen Table Politics. And I hope you stay tuned. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and welcome Laurel.
Hi.
Thanks so much.
To be here.
Yes, Laurel is home for just kind of a little bit of a long weekend or a short weekend even. She has to fly back on Tuesday. So Laurel currently teaches at Thurgood Marshall in Washington, D.C. It's an award-winning public charter school. But let's go back, Laurel. And let's talk about some of your early influences. And what do you feel has shaped your interest in education?
It's interesting. So being back on the Lopez Island or within this community, you know, you feel those forces that have guided my path in many ways. And growing up, I was always interested in working with kids and youth that kind of carried me from one summer to the next and had a passion myself for learning. And thinking about kind of what guided my interest in education, I'll start with at Scripps College and then work backwards. I began with an interest in education and moved through a psychology degree. And through my time at Scripps, became more and more interested in working with young men and women, particularly young men who had become involved in gangs in the LA area, and looking at the issue of juvenile delinquency and how can we address the needs of these young people that are perhaps not being addressed and are driving them, you know, along certain paths or to do certain things. And became interested in policy and looking at that piece. And then senior year really came back to education and realized how in many ways education is almost a public health approach to the issue of juvenile delinquency. And just a statistic that particularly stands out in my mind was cited by Jonathan Kozol in his book Savage Inequalities. And that was that 90% of the inmates in a particular prison in upstate New York had not completed high school. And, you know, certainly correlation and causation are not one and the same, but just an incredibly powerful statistic for me. But thinking backwards, kind of, you know, that drove my decision to directly after college enter the world of education through Teach for America, actually. But, you know, earlier on, I had incredibly powerful forces who really drove my curiosity for learning. And the community, the Lopez community, and then broader, more the San Juan community, I think I was impacted by both the teachers who were influencing my life in the classroom, those who were outside of the classroom, and also a community that I felt accountable to, that asked me how I was doing, what I was learning. And so I think that kind of those pieces of inspiring teachers who taught me beyond the walls of the classroom and took me beyond the walls of the classroom physically, you know, working with certain teachers, looking at conservation of wetlands by actually going to a wetland.
Who were some of those teachers? Put some names here.
Yeah. So thinking back from the initial, you know, Miss Patty, in kindergarten, I think, you know, I had 2 years with Kathleen Sand. In first and second grade, we had a combined class my second year. And we as second graders, Bethy Johnstonbaugh, Alan Jeffries, Alia Dumond, and I were in a special poetry writing group that would go out into the Rishi Center and hold colorful pieces of paper up to various things and look at how perspective changed based on color. And, you know, starting off there, moving to, you know, and certainly each year had a different thing that kind of drove, you know, from Mr. Shreve to Miss Burleson. And then, you know, particularly, I think a lot about Greg Ewart. And as many may know, that's a particularly present character in my mind right now and in my thoughts. And Greg really, I think, influenced me in how he addressed the social-emotional aspects of students and integrated a concept of community and accountability into the classroom, in just how we reflected on working with each other as students, and how we were also accountable, therefore, to a larger community, to the Lopez community and to the world. You know, everything from going on service trips, you know, around to going and spending time in an old growth forest and really appreciating and learning about nature in that regard. And then also, you know, developing a project called My Utopia, where we even had to look at weather and think about all of the pieces that go into making a functional community and environment. And then I transitioned to Spring Street, and there, one of the most influential teachers for me was Ted Hope, who taught all of our social studies classes, including world religions, AP psychology, a lot of courses that really pushed us to think beyond ourselves. And he, like Greg and Kathleen, all used creative ways of encouraging us to think beyond. And not just delivering answers and delivering information, but really engaging us as critical thinkers. Mm-hmm. I think a lot, I've this year just entered into a fellowship with the North Carolina Outward Bound School. Mm-hmm. And it's called the Kurt Hahn Fellowship. But I've been exploring really actively the principles of Outward Bound. And they have these five driving principles of craftsmanship, self-reliance, gosh, I would have to refer back for all of them, but courage, and then, but what I love is the above all, compassion. And I feel like all of those educators really fostered that in mm-hmm. the classrooms they created.
Well, you're a very articulate woman about some of the things that have shaped your interest in education, and I need to take a breath. We have a common mentor. Jonathan Kozels informed me for 40 years. Mm. He's probably been writing that long. I believe his first book was Death at an Early Age.
Oh, interesting.
And he continues to evolve as someone who has a lot to say about education in this country. But I'm just so struck with, if I had a thread to say about what you're, to describe what you're saying that your curiosity and your mentors took you out of your own cultural perspective, even perhaps out of your own language and your own understanding of the world, into a broader sea of humanity and perspectives. And you articulate that so beautifully, Laurel.
Thank you.
So I'd like to go on, and it seems the next step might be for you to talk about what, and I'm sure there's some of the factors you've already spoken of, but what do you feel have been some of the major forces that have shaped your philosophy of teaching and how you teach?
Certainly. You know, I think that these educators that I've already mentioned and the community certainly have driven kind of as models and kind of things that I think about daily as I approach the classroom that have really developed me as a student and as, I guess, I feel like I still would categorize myself as a student of this world. But I feel like, you know, certainly this concept of community and the concept of educating the whole child and a whole person, I think has really shaped the direction that I've taken in the classroom. And I attended a conference this past, or not this past fall, but the fall before, hosted by the Mind Life Institute and the Dalai Lama, called Educating World Citizens for the 21st Century.
Great title. It makes my heart sing.
And it really raised a lot of these important questions of who are we developing as students? You know, what is the outcome that we see from our, you know, when we graduate students? What do we see? And are our schools and our system of public education developing the individuals that we hope to see? And a lot, you know, it brought together these incredible minds from all fields, from psychology, from policy, to, you know, education reformers, to Marion Wright Edelman, all of these incredibly, you know, brilliant and also just multifaceted individuals. And a lot of the questions came back to the idea of citizens and citizens of this world. And creating citizens in waiting and individuals who, yes, have this basic knowledge and, you know, can complete basic multiplication and all of that, but thinking about creating citizens in waiting of sorts, and treating young people like they are a resource and not a problem. Because if we think about these young people coming through a system of education that's constantly said, you know, you're a behavior problem, you don't know enough, all of these pieces, you don't, you know, various messages, they enter the world and who knows what they feel. But if you're constantly reaffirming a message of you are of value, you have something to offer. We need you. Yes.
You belong to us. You belong right. in this world, and we have work to do together.
Right. And thinking about looking at that person that we hope to develop, and certainly not, you know, we don't want to have one idea of who our, what our future looks like, but thinking backwards from that, and instead of using the system that we have that, you know, we've acknowledged has a lot of things that need and can be changed, thinking about how we conceptualize education from the outcome that we hope for. And I think a lot about that just in terms of also our justice system. In my senior thesis in Scripps, I looked a lot at restorative justice, and I'm excited to hear that Lopez has recently hosted, you know, a speaker, and now we'll be hosting a training about that.
Correct.
And I think about our justice system and how in so many ways we have this system that's in place. And is that system designed in such a way that the outcome is something that we desire? And if we think instead about, you know, the idea of who we want to be exiting the justice system, do we want it to be what we currently are producing? I think that that's a hard question and one that takes a lot of financial resources and mental resources to really come around. But I think that both of these systems, public education and our justice system, need that drastic shift of looking at the outcome that we want and looking backwards.
Very wise perspective, Laurel. Mm. Marion Wright Edelman was also one of my mentors. I was I just love it when those elders, so to speak, yes. roll off your tongue. That, and I'm an elder at 68, and yet they were my mentors.
Yeah.
So they're like the grandparents, really, I guess.
Yeah.
I've been privileged to share it, meet both of them and testify with them in Washington, D.C. They are so inspiring.
Yeah.
Marion Wright Edelman, particularly, and her just dedication to youth. And I'll tell a brief story about that she told at a conference I was at. They were trying to, this was years ago, oh gosh, this was 40 years, 35 years ago. They were trying to decide how to, kids were getting shot on their way to school in the neighborhood that she was working in at the time. And, you know, I thought it was Philadelphia, but I'm not quite sure what. It was a large inner city, and I don't believe it was Washington, D.C. And she was a fairly young woman then. And kids were getting shot on the way to school. And the police department and the public authorities came up with the idea that they would buy back the guns. And her response was from the students. And her response was, you know, this isn't really a student. The students shouldn't be the only ones that solve this problem. And the solution was that all the shop owners stood on the street to give the children safe passage. And I've used
the hair on my arms is raising.
And I've used that as a metaphor my whole life, that the adults, I mean, that's what we're here for. We should be like you are, standing in the street, giving our children safe passage. So it's inspiring to know that you've got your feet on the ground walking on those streets. And I want to... let's go ahead. I want to hear more about scripts.
Yeah.
And then we'll move forward to where you're teaching and something specific. But tell me about scripts. It's clearly been very influential in your life.
Yeah. So scripts is interesting. It, you know, I ended up getting into scripts off of the wait list. It was something I had decided that I was going to go to UW. That was, you know, it came down to it, and I was settled on University of Washington, which, you know, offered a fabulous program in psychology. And I remember I came home from school early one day from Spring Street feeling sick. And there was a message on our answering machine from Pat Goldsmith, the dean of admission. And she said, you know, Laurel, I would like to offer you a place in, you know, the class of 2008 at Scripps College. And I thought that I was dreaming. Fortunately for me, I wasn't. And Scripps offered an incredible education in terms of, it's a woman's college. It's the Woman's College of the Claremonts. And the Claremont Consortium, it's 35 miles east of LA. And it's this, there's five schools and there's no separation between the campuses. So it's this similar structure to the Seven Sisters on the East Coast, except for there's no geographic separation. And each college has a particular strength in general. But you can take classes at any of the five colleges.
What are the names of all five of the colleges?
So there's Scripps College, Harvey Mudd, which is really strong in engineering, Pitzer, which does a lot of the social sciences and really produces strong activists, Claremont McKenna, which is really strong in business and finance and government. And actually, we have a Lopez graduate, Kestrel Arps, who went to Claremont McKenna. And there is Pomona College, which is the oldest of the Claremonts.
Right. That's where Steve Young taught.
Yes, yes.
In literature, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. We barely missed each other, I think. But what I loved about Scripps is it offered both the strength of a woman's college and reaffirming that message of you can and will shape this world. There's one of my favorite quotes of all time is actually by Eleanor Browning Scripps. And it says that the obligation of a college is to develop in its students the ability to think clearly and independently and the ability to live confidently, courageously, and hopefully. And I feel like that college gave me the gift of strengthening that voice. And the beauty of it was you have this message, and the campus brings incredible speakers who really talk to women's issues and things that are relevant and particularly important to, you know, that kind of world. But then you're not isolated from, you know, all of these other schools that are right there. And every class except for the first year humanities class has young men in it as well. All of your classes are, you know, open to the other schools. So there's not that, you know, separation from the world that may happen. And what I love in many ways is that Scripps functioned for me like the San Juan Islands. I lived on Lopez Island and commuted to Spring Street on San Juan. And each island has its own character and has something different to offer. And in many ways, that was what Scripps was. It offered its own small community that really allowed you know, individuals to flourish and, you know, develop beautiful and personal relationships with professors and, you know, really become integrated in a small community. But it had the resources of a much larger community that, you know, I took advantage of by going to Spring Street, and I took advantage of by going to courses on other campuses. But I really, you know, I think that growing up on the islands, I had a comfort in interacting with adults and individuals in so many different realms of life that when I got to college, it was just natural for me to develop relationships with, you know, both administrators and faculty and staff on mm-hmm. campus. And, you know, I had friendships with the grounds crew and friendships with, you know, the various deans. So it was a really rich experience for me.
Well, one of the things, now we're going to kind of move toward where your feet are right now, but one of the things you spoke of earlier was your interest while you were still, I assume, a student in the LA area, because you've moved through several, many cultures of which you were not exposed to here in the San Juans. One of them is the gang culture, and another is ethnic diversity.
Yes.
The African-American culture and the Asian culture and the immigrant culture, which is very broad-based, Latino, I won't even begin to mention. And so those are all, I mean, it, going back to the color behind the plant, so that, or behind something so that you could see a different perspective.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny how all those early experiences, I'm only guessing at this, left you curious and open to those perspectives, which were very different and in many ways contradictory to the values and beliefs you'd grown up with. So talk a little bit about your early exposure to those different cultures.
You know, it's interesting. I think that I did some traveling with my family as a kid, but, you know, my mom would always tell stories or sometimes told stories about her time during the 60s in Berkeley. You know, she was very active during the civil rights movement. And that was something that was always present that I heard. And then at Spring Street, we did traveling internationally, both to South America and to Thailand and India. And in both of those, you know, in those trips, we there was always a service component. And also, we always stayed either with families or, you know, we were camping or it was a very different mode of traveling. And I think that, you know, it's interesting. I've actually thought about this a lot because just thinking about how I enter communities and how I enter the community where I teach. And I think that it's something that's similar to how Spring Street and my parents also raised me in traveling. And when you approach both, you know, a different culture, or even just, you know, within your own culture, a different individual with respect and dignity, and a general belief and assumption that there is goodness within each person, some goodness, you know, maybe they're not the perfect, you know, model citizen, but there's some goodness within each person. And that's everyone and every community has something to offer. I think that it changes how you enter and how you relate to an individual and to a community with an openness. And like you mentioned, that curiosity. I always used to get frustrated. I remember my mom, you know, she would start a conversation with everyone, including the airport or shuttle driver. And I would be like, oh, God, here we go again. Another personal conversation with, you know, a random stranger. But, it, you know, thinking about it now, my mom ascribed value to every individual that she encountered. No matter who you were, she wanted to know. And that desire and that belief, I think, really affected me and really moved me as an individual, how I went forth. And, you know, I think that also there have been, you know, a lot of experiences both at Scripps and, you know, even before, that have really challenged me to think about how I interact. I had a friend in college, and we were having a conversation one day in the library, and I had been involved in bringing speakers to campus and very involved in the public speaking, you know, who researching who to bring and when to bring and all of the scheduling. Mm-hmm. And we were having a conversation about somebody that she had found, an African-American, I think it was a scientist. I can't remember exactly who it was. And she mentioned their name and talked about their work just briefly. And, you know, I said, oh, do you think we could bring them during African-American History Month? And she's like, do you realize how inherently racist you are to assume that we can only celebrate this person's achievement during that month? And in the moment, I became so defensive and said, oh, wait, but I'm not racist. I don't do these active things that I, assume are, you know, imply that. And it really, I am so grateful for that. It really forced me to think about how it is not just so simple as it runs so much deeper. And I think that one thing that's really helped me in interacting with, you know, things that are not that I'm not familiar with is being open mm-hmm. to being wrong and acknowledging that and growing from it. And it's how we respond in those situations that really, really influence the direction that we move beyond.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things that's interesting that it, and what you're saying makes perfect sense. And yet I still find a huge gap in my own experience between, and I haven't traveled a lot, but when the few places I've been, between traveling to other countries and then traveling to other countries within this country,
yes.
An Indian reservation, a prison, where I, for years, as a young woman, I was in my early 30s, I felt like my innocence was being peeled off of me one mm-hmm. layer at a time. And it was so painful to realize how little I knew.
Yeah. Yes.
And that's got to be a piece of your world.
Yeah. You know, certainly, especially, you know, I'm teaching special education,
right.
9th and 10th grade special education. And as a special education teacher, you read narratives in psychological reports and in social, you know, all of these social history pieces where you know a lot more information in order to serve the needs of a student. But
right.
It's incredible what that path has been for so many. And, you know, it's interesting. It's an interesting thing to hear those experiences and, you know, initially you just feel so overwhelmed and you feel the burden and the weight. And, you know, last year was the first time that I had a student who was HIV positive.
That you knew of.
That I knew of. That exactly. Who had disclosed to me.
Right.
And it was very interesting for me to deal with my own fear and take in that information and be able to be a support for him and navigate what that support looked like. And I think that in so many ways, you know, their experiences evoke fear. And what do I do with that fear? You know, and I think that for me, I listened to an NPR piece last year, and I actually played it for my students. And it was about a young girl with Williams syndrome. And Williams syndrome, one of the results is that the children lack any social fear. And so what this mother was describing was training her daughter to be afraid. And I just remember, I think it was Terry Gross who was doing the piece. Mm-hmm. And she ended with, you know, just a statement of Caitlin, I think I can't remember her name, but it was is so trusting of this world, but this world is not worthy of her trust.
Mm-hmm.
And I posed the question to my students about, you know, what are your reactions to that statement of, you know, this world being unworthy? And I think that it is just so saddening in many ways that, you know, they move through experiences that you wish that you could just erase.
We really can't even quite imagine. And the important thing is, I think, as you say, to move beyond fear. I was a little older than you are and more astonished at my own ignorance, just totally overwhelmingly astonished at my own ignorance, both about my unaware racism, and which, you know, man, yeah. I'm still walking that path because we were born with a skin that provides us with entitlement beyond what we can even understand. But I recall reading in a journal or something you sent about a student who was going to participate in a special program or something, and you called to make sure it was okay. And his father's house had burned down the day before, and they had lost everything.
Yeah.
And he didn't know if he was going to come to school that day. And that family was not surrounded at that point by, I'm sure they had family and friends, but by resources that the Lopez community can call into the front without even thinking about it.
Right.
And all the people, I mean, we're right where I wanted to go in the interview because I want to now explore more about where you are, who the students you're teaching, and what those, I mean, the potential. It's so exciting where you are, where you are. You must say a gratitude every day to have had the opportunity to be exactly where you are.
Yeah.
So talk more about.
Yeah. So where I am, I'll just give a kind of a brief overview. It Thurgood Marshall Academy. It's a public charter high school. So serving 9th through 12th grade, and it's a Title I public charter, which means that over 70% of our students are on free or reduced lunch. And that's a common measure of the poverty level within schools. And 99.99% of my students are African American. So when people say, oh, it's so wonderful that you teach in such a diverse school, I say by diversity, you mean minority. So that's kind of the general population. And like many DC public schools, we have a pyramid structure where we have a huge 9th grade, a smaller 10th grade, a smaller 11th grade, and a minute 12th grade.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that falls in line with this unfortunate statistics in the area, you know, if I think something like 1 in 6 graduate high school. Or it may even be that statistic for college. And
this is the whole high school, which is not all special education, but
we have a relatively small special education department and a small portion of students receiving support services.
Right.
Although in my mind, we call it special education, but in so many ways, every student it could benefit from an education that's tailored to their needs.
Absolutely. Every single student should have a special education.
Right.
Yeah, so I'm on board with that.
Yeah. So it's been very interesting. Our school is in an area called Anacostia, and it's Ward 8. It's where Mary and Barry used to really represent, and I think still he is serving on the council as a voice for us. But it is one of the most statistically depressed areas of DC. I think it's 20% unemployment or upwards from there.
Do you have boarded up neighborhoods?
Yes. The building, there are buildings, you know, a few doors down that are completely covered, and every building has bars on the windows. Our school is the only school in the neighborhood, that does not have a metal detector at the front door.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting. I actually ride the bus to school.
Mm-hmm.
And I moved this
the
past...
The school bus? Or
no,
a public
transportation bus. And it was very interesting my first year. I've now moved, and so I'm on a different bus route, but still on the bus. And my first year, it took me a little while to get used to the fact that at a certain point, you cross over the river, and we're in an area that's known as East of the River,
mm-hmm.
and it is a different Washington. And I want to come back to the idea of these different places, different countries that we visit within our own country.
Yeah.
It's particularly relevant in DC, and you know, I when I was on the bus, the last stop before you cross over the river is the Navy Yard. And I would be on the bus, and there's, you know, some diversity on the bus.
Right.
But after we passed that Navy Yard stop, everybody would kind of turn to me on the bus, like, lady, didn't you realize the last white person stop was back there?
Yeah, you're... are you on the right bus?
Right. Are you aware that you're about to cross the river? And it was very interesting. I actually, you know, and since then I've developed a good relationship with the various bus drivers.
Yeah.
And one thing I love about the buses is there's a general community that ride the same bus each day. So I have, you know, now in the place that I'm in, I ride with a lot of my same students and I end up helping them with homework on the morning bus and various things like that. But this idea of a different nation within our own nation was particularly articulated during a visit that we took to the museum with a group of students. And there was an exhibit of the Berlin Wall. And I raised the question to the students of, you know, isn't it interesting that within this city, depending on what side of the wall you were on, you had an entirely different experience, an entirely different access to resources.
Yep.
And I, you know, of course, knowing the answer to my own question, but still posing it, you know, I asked, is there a parallel that anybody can draw to something that they've either heard of or seen or experienced? Every hand shoots into the air and echoes the same response, Washington, D.C.
Right. And the river is the wall?
The river is one wall. Mm-hmm. It's where the legend of the map is usually smack dab over where Anacostia is. So if you look for it on a map, look for the legend and you won't be able to find much more.
Mm-hmm.
But more generally, the difference between those who are on Capitol Hill and those who are living in the city.
Yeah.
And, you know, those invisible walls, or actually rather visible, but, you know, lacking physical structure.
Right.
And I think, you know, it's interesting. Actually, I was talking with Greg Ewart, thinking of these educators, and I mentioned just going to that exhibit, and he was talking about a project that he did about walls around the world and why walls are built and what walls represent, and, you know, everything from the wall in Israel, you know, to the Berlin Wall, to all of these different walls throughout the globe. And the idea of what creates walls and barriers between us. And I think, you know, going throughout this conversation, one thing that really impacts what I do is trying to remove those walls. And actually, Obama, in a speech in Cairo, said, you know, we can focus on the things that drive us apart, or we can focus, you know, with everything that we can possibly bring together on developing that community and togetherness, mm-hmm. and imagining a future for our children that has that peace. And I just think that that is so important, and particularly within special education. Our school uses an inclusion model, which means that I follow my students into their classes. You know, they're not in a separate school. We have one class that's called Resource Workshop that they do come to every other day where it's just the students that mm-hmm. I support. But other than that, they're in the general education classes. Mm-hmm. And in my practice, I really work to break any kind of perceivable walls down, whether it's a wall that's built around disability
mm-hmm.
and a notion that I can't do that because of this. Or if it's a wall between students of, oh, well, they're the smart kids, I'm not. Or, you know, I'm using a wheelchair, they're not. Whatever wall that has been created, I find walls to be so destructive.
Yeah. Absolutely. Even the wall, of which is seldom spoken because the shame is such an underlying river in our culture, the wall of I'm not smart enough.
Yeah.
I can't really. And I mean, the truth of the matter is they don't have the information they need yet to understand what's being said. But the translation unconsciously and unspoken is I'm not smart enough.
Right. Right.
And I can't speak to that. I mean, it's a horrific thing we've done to our young people.
Yeah.
Yeah. That we have to, you and all of us, have a commitment and a responsibility to undo. And yeah. you're working. What's your day like?
Yeah, there is no typical day in special education in Washington, D.C. You know, I wake up at 6:45, get on that bus and head over the river. And then this year particularly, I have a student who is overall functioning both socially, academically, cognitively, processing every piece between a kindergarten and second grade level. Mm-hmm. And working to figure out how to meaningfully include him in a general education classroom.
Like has ninth been grade?
In ninth grade.
And so yes. he's how old, 15 or
he's
something?
He's 13 and a half. He'll be 14 very soon. And so my day starts out with him coming into my office and me going with him. For the first month, it was opening his locker because we have just last week, for the first time, opened his locker on his own. But before that, we were getting books and going to our first period class. And then I will be in classes with my students. And depending on the class, I may be teaching alongside the other teacher and leading a lesson. I may be, you know, leading a lesson and then we'll switch off. Or I may pull a small group of students to another room to really focus on, you know, a reading strategy or reviewing information. And what I love is the relationships that I've been able to develop with faculty, you know, where that I don't just support my students. And we've found that it's so much more meaningful when I take a group of students that's not just mine, but mm-hmm. or not just students that I support, but, you know, a variety of students.
Right.
So that my students don't feel separated. They right. don't feel and all students feel like they have an additional resource that I feel is really, you know, important. But another component to my life, unfortunately, you know, within the world of special education, we have a lot of legal paperwork to do. So my day also is consumed by administrative ends. And then there's a lot of meetings that happen, especially, you know, in developing individualized education plans yeah. for the students, looking at the levels of support. And then a lot of my day is also addressing those social emotional pieces of keeping my students in the classroom physically. Yeah. And then this year I started coaching volleyball. So yeah. with the absence of being done with Teach for America and being done with grad school, I've now taken on volleyball coaching, which is absolutely wonderful.
Oh, I bet. You can meet your students on a whole nother yes, court, so to yes. speak, metaphorically and practically.
So many life lessons yeah. and... You know, you lose so much, or you win so much more from the losses than you yeah. do from, you yeah. know, those successes and triumphs. That it's been really interesting. And, you know, it's actually funny. You brought up the issue earlier of color. And a particular game recently, we lost. But before the game, we were having some conversation. And one of the students was like, "Miss Horn, you know you're black." And I was like, "Oh, you really? You know, like, let me..." ask a little bit more. And she said, "You know, you're one of us." And then another student jokingly said, "Oh, Miss Horn, you Jew?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'm Jewish." And she's like, "See, I knew you were black. That just proves it." and you know, we went on. You know, I was really touched. But we went on, played the game. We didn't win, unfortunately. But, you know, we walked away, and one of the students, I must have looked a little bit down, and one of the students said, "Oh, Miss Horn, don't be upset. You received the biggest compliment that we can give." And I said, "What was that?" And she said, "That you're black."
Wow. There's not much that could equal that in any kind of award you're ever going to get. Mm. We still have a few minutes, but it yeah. brings me right up to something you don't know I'm going to do.
Ah!
And I did read carefully everything that I received in advance of our interview. And this is a letter, I'm just going to read the first paragraph, that was written, and I'm assuming it was written by a student who was filling out their college entrance application. Mm-hmm. And the question on every college entrance application I've ever seen is, who is the most influential person mm-hmm. in your life? And it was another teacher. It was written for another teacher, not to Laurel. But the other teacher wisely chose to share this with Laurel. So I'd like to read you just this first paragraph of this young woman, I'm not going to say her name, who is looking toward high school and answering the question, who is the most influential person in your life? Throughout my entire high school career, there have always been individuals that I could and have turned to for advice, support, and guidance. Since I have been at Thurgood Marshall for 3 years, there is one particular individual that instantly comes to mind. This person is hardworking, dedicated, motivated, loves watching the students learn, and is positive. I have been affiliated with this person for the first 2 years of my high school academics. The person also works at Thurgood Marshall Academy. If it was not for this supporter, I am not sure that I would have been able to maintain my academic performances as well as I have. Not only has she assisted me in my academics, she is known throughout the building as someone who will, quote, assist anyone that seeks or needs help. The individual that I'm referring to is Miss Laurel Horn, student support teacher. And that's just the beginning of a 1.5-page article. And I say this not to embarrass you, but it comes right on the heels of the compliments your students gave you. And I just can't say enough. I hope there are thousands of you out there. Are there? I mean, are there? You know what I'm asking.
Yeah.
Who care the way you do? Who are curious about who are you and who what how what can I how do I fit in here and how can I make the most meaningful contribution?
You know, that's an interesting question because there are so many inspired young educators, and certainly, you know, the conduit that I came through, Teach for America, is really working to bring those young and energetic and just, you know, those young people into the world of education. But I think that social emotional piece is something that far too often is overlooked.
Right.
And, you know, it's very interesting. You know, recently there was a thing that I did with the Department of Education. And one of the questions that I asked to Secretary Duncan is, with this focus on high stakes testing, where is the creativity afforded to teachers? And I think that similarly, we have begun to put a priority on what's tested. And social, emotional, and self-reflection and self-awareness, those pieces are not tested.
Right.
And we as teachers, it's incumbent upon us at this point, you know, to really address that piece. And I can only hope that there are, you know, there's a force of us out there who are really gouging at that,
right,
that piece.
Well, it brings up when we are going to have to close, but I definitely want to have another interview that we will schedule, because we haven't even begun to talk about bringing up Arne Duncan and public policy around schools. And you're in the hotbed in so many ways, because
Michelle Rees.
Rees is, I mean, she's on news almost every night.
Yes.
And so there's so much. I just am so grateful that you were here today to share your personal journey. And I can tell that you also are a policy wonk in a way. Well, you can't really work in a system that you know needs changing,
right,
without becoming somewhat of a policy wonk that you can ask,
yes,
questions to Arne Duncan about things like that. So thank you so much, Laurel.
Oh, well.
Thank you for your articulate and heartfelt portrait of your students and your life.
Well, I so appreciate this opportunity, and I value this community beyond and what any word can articulate, but I'm honored and delighted to have had this time with you. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. And this is KLOI-LP, Lopez Island, Washington, 102.9 FM. And good day to you.